The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I am Yuyun Zhan, host of our monthly podcast, Zhonghua Mundus, that brings you recent updates about China's economy. As usual, I have my co-host, our senior fellow, Alicia Garcia Herrero.
Hi, Alicia.
Hello, Yuyun. How are you doing?
Good, good. And today we're also joined by Cecilia Trazzi, Senior Policy Advisor on Industry and Trade at Eco Think Tank, and also a Bruegel alumni. Welcome back, Cecilia.
Thank you for having me again. I'm very happy to meet you in this form.
Yeah, exactly, in your new title. And I think it's your first time joining the China podcast, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Perfect. Let's just dive into it. So in this episode, we want to explore EU-China climate relations ahead of COP30 taking place in November. So let's start with the big picture. How would you describe the current state of EU-China climate relations, especially as we look ahead to COP30? Cecilia.
Thank you for the question. I would say that the state of EU-China relationship ahead, and say, specifically the climate relationship ahead of COP30, is paradoxical in one word. So it is symbolically strong on paper. However, it is quite, structurally strained by trade tensions, divergent ambitions, and also the complex reality of having to deal with, in a way, global climate leadership or global climate action without the United States. So the reason why I say that it's paradoxical is because on one hand, it does reflect genuine willingness to cooperate. So the most significant shift in that sense was in 2005 was the EU and China positioning themselves not by, again, I don't think by design, but mostly by necessity, as the de facto leaders of, the multilateral climate governance. So in July, at the July summit between EU and China in Beijing, both parties issued a statement that pledging to demonstrate leadership together to drive a global just transition. This symbolic commitment lacked, however, concrete new pledges. But at the same time, it did represent an effort to stabilize climate diplomacy and also to ensure that climate diplomacy remains an open channel for dialogue between EU and China. Because on the other hand, instead, what you have is that clearly, trade tensions are harsh. I mean, just this month, so in October 2025, not even this month, like last week, essentially, the export controls on rare earths by China that are aimed at US, they do have negative consequences for Europe as well. In fact, we have that in particular, like in the automotive and machinery sector, we have around 2,000 export license applications that are just pending. Only 50% of those are being properly addressed. And you have that the EU Commissioner for Trade and Security, so Sefcovic, economic security, is calling, for no escalation, urgently calling his Chinese counterparts in Brussels to just, decrease, let's say, the tension, decrease the temperature in the room. So I would say that it is both general cooperation, significant friction, and therefore a climate partnership that is more pragmatic rather than, let's say, enthusiastic. But I do think that's enough. I do think that for climate, when I say about fighting for the margin, pragmatic, it's good.
Yeah, Alicia also wrote a piece about rare earth that just got published at Bruegel last week. We would also include this in the show notes. So for audience who are interested in this, you can also have a further read on that. But it's very interesting that you use paradoxical to describe this relationship between China and EU on climate. And in your recent analysis on this topic, you also use the phrase convergence, no alignment. Could you just explain a bit what exactly does that mean in the context of climate cooperation?
For sure. So let me take a step back first. And by saying that both China and Europe are operating from, in a sense, the same structural logic. So they both see the green transition not only as a, allow me the word climate imperative, if you want, but more and more as a strategic race for future competitiveness. And this is true for both. So the real question is not whether we share an interest, because we do. It's more whether we can align narratives and instruments in a way that avoids turning this shared ambition into a zero-sum rivalry. So with the phrase convergence and not alignment, I mean that both sides should work towards a similar, let's say, similar outcomes. For example, advancing emission trading systems, potentially even arriving to couple their emission trading system, scaling up green finance, setting higher standards for clean technologies, for example, but without expecting that their policies, their targets, or their governance models to become identical or fully harmonized. I mean, they shall, gradually move towards shared objectives or compatible technical standards through mutual learning, pilot programs, pragmatic cooperation. So all things that in a way are already happening. And what I'm arguing is, let's keep on going. Let's keep on going. The EU and China are operate in a completely different universe when we talk about, green transition. So alignment would mean adopting the same rules, targets, or enforcement mechanism, or also even being on the same timeline for decarbonization. But it's just not realistic and a risk just because, adding toxicity to the relationship. So this is what I meant with convergence and not alignment.
Alicia, let me come back to you. So you and I, we've been talking a lot on EU-China relations, and we know that China is seen by the EU as a partner, a competitor, and also systemic rival all at once. How does this complex relationship shape the EU's climate strategy toward China?
Thanks, Chidi, for sharing. I think I need to start from your point of how diametrically different our approach is to the same objective. Yeah, I mean, the objective, you can argue, of course, net zero is later at China, but in a way that it makes sense given the amount of emissions and the level of development. So forgetting about the actual deadline, we could argue that the objective is the same, but the way in which we want to achieve this objective is diametrically different, as you said. And why is the method important? You may say, well, never mind, like we are all aiming at the same goal. Well, how you aim at that goal affects the other. That's the problem. China's approach to the green transition is an approach that puts first supply rather than reduction of demand, that puts first ability to produce green tech rather than reduce necessarily emissions through pricing. And that doesn't end in China because it so happens that this green tech is basically transferable, meaning it's exportable, meaning it is obviously a very important source of revenue for China. So because of that, I mean, if we were both in two separate islands trying to decarbonize, nothing of what I just said would matter. Yeah, you do it in your way, I do it in my way. Because this is not the case, China's choice, both in terms of the supply versus demand options, but also the order of decarbonization, and I come back to that in a second, has huge impact on Europe. So, to make a long story short, what is the order? In China, the order is quite clear. It's transport first and installation of renewables in the grid. By the way, by no means at the speed of Europe, which is interesting because if you produce all of these renewables, why not install them immediately? Although the installation has really been front-loaded very quickly because China did want to announce peaking before the deadline, which was 2030, possibly 2027, if not earlier. So they did do a lot of installation. But these installed renewables are not necessarily generating green energy, because a lot of the renewables are not even, yes, they are installed, but they're not hooked, if you want, to the grid. Again, because China is focusing on the targets, not on the reduction of emissions. This is totally different. This is why, well, you mentioned the ETS market. China has what I would call, if you want, window shop ETS market. Yeah, you show it. It has a price that hardly changes. And it basically does not signal anything because it's not the purpose of that ETS marker. So, even with instruments that have the same names, we're talking about different things here. The fact that China has moved, as I said, into transport and renewables, mostly both for exports, yeah, especially renewable, especially solar panels. Like in 2024, two-thirds of China's solar panels were exported. So it is really unbelievable if you think about it, yeah. And China is hardly starting the hard part of it, which is the industrial decarbonization. Says it all about the strategy. The strategy is an industrial policy strategy. And Europe is basically doing something very different. It's making it very costly, and therefore very costly also for the European economy, yeah, to decarbonize. And it's very costly not to decarbonize, i.e., you decarbonize, but it is costly. China is making it like a windfall. Yeah, is you if you produce green tech, you can export it, you have revenue, your companies become global players. So it's on a carrot mode. Europe is on a stick mode. Yeah, this is very different. And as such, it has enormous implications for the two leaders, as you mentioned, that signed the very same piece of paper in Beijing, but meaning something very different. Yeah, I mean, so I would say, as long as we do not talk about the method, how close the method can be, there will indeed be losers and winners. And I'm sorry to say, Europe is on the losing side of things because of this different approach.
Chichila, do you want to chip in here on the different methods?
I think not even a different method, even more like on the different understanding. I agree very much with what Alicia said. Like, we might be talking about the same thing, better use the same terms and mean completely different things. And this happens over and over again.
Okay. Since the methods is so different, but then also, Cecilia, in your beginning, you mentioned there are still very concrete and pragmatic ways that the two economies can collaborate on. Could you share with us some examples on the concrete area where you and China are actually converging on climate?
Sure. So I think that in general, like as a general principle, the more technical you go, the better, in terms of cooperation between you and China. So and this includes, for example, when finance, so in 2020, they launched a common ground taxonomy to essentially improve the cross-border sustainable investment, if you want, like green investment, by finding commonalities between the EU and China green finance systems. There was an effort defining what green was, defining what exactly, where these sustainable investments. Then there was an updated version of that in 2022 that identified this, let's say, more than 70 green activities, let's call them green, and then was then further expanded into a multi-jurisdiction common ground taxonomy, which is, at the end of the day, a technical reference tool for financial institutions and investors alike. It is not legally binding, but it does seem as a reference framework that to enhance interoperability of these markets. In the same vein, talks about interoperability of standards for under the ESO framework, for example, for EV charge infrastructure, or literally like batteries. These talks exist and are extremely important for the further we go in this clean tech race. Another area is cooperation or better, let's say, exchanges on carbon accounting methodologies. So there are multiple ways to account for carbon in the different industries. They can be input based. So, for example, in the power sector, how much coal, did you use? And so you just, associated the emission factor of coal, you understand, and you literally multiply for the amount of coal you used. And in fact, it's easier usually, to account for, I'm simplifying a lot here, but it's easier to account for carbon in the power sector. But then there are also activity-based methodologies and a hybrid between the two. And because Europe has already done, the task of trying to sort out what methodology to use in which sector and how, what kind of emission factors do you use, which region of reference. And China instead is going through this process right now. So the Chinese ETS has been introduced only in 2021 and initially was only covering the power sector. Only recently, literally a few, let's say, weeks / months ago, has it extended also to steel, cement, aluminum. So it's still grappling with a lot of the same questions that you went through. And this is an area where cooperation is working well. Another area where, that I would like to see scale up more is circular economy and recycling. So this is a, on one hand, I mean, Europe is quite advanced compared to China when it comes to a regulatory framework for the circular economy and recycling. So, for example, we're talking about batteries. The EU battery regulation has clear set defined targets for the lithium recovery by 2027 and 2031. It also has pilot projects, also, for example, in the solar sector, and it uses more, how can I say, and recycling or say circular by design approach. In more and more use of technologies. On the other hand, instead, China has huge scale, as always, has huge scale, so a huge availability of end-of-life batteries or panels, but also scrap metals, and possibly the world's most, let's say, deepest and widest collection network. So by combining the two, there is a huge, not only learning opportunity, but also a huge market opportunity for both. In 2023, there was a high-level dialogue that was launched in the circular economy between EU and China, and there was a pilot project to which there were which were account allocated around 2.8 billion euros, which it's a small sum. So what I would like to see is more of this kind of this kind of initiatives and scale up this kind of projects. Finally, something that is I see more and more taking hold, but still I think has to really realize is cooperation in third countries. So triangular cooperation, for example, with countries in Africa. Both Europe and China invest heavily in, I mean, to different extent, but they do invest in clean energy infrastructure and critical raw materials. Surprisingly, there is not so much, how can I say, this direct competition, not so much overlap as one would think. Mostly because they're interested in different things and financing different things. The EU and China could get together and pool these scarce resources, would just be great. I mean, it would be beneficial for the third country. It would be beneficial also from in terms of a market opportunity. We're talking about a huge, hugely untapped economic potential in the African continent. And at the same time, if I may, it's also an easy win from a geopolitical standpoint. If they can, you know, present themselves as credible partners for sustainable development, I mean, and it's just an increase of power for both in these countries.
I want to go back to this idea of cooperation because you started like this, cooperate, partners, competitors, rivals. So let me give you a number that I think says it all up about the level of competition, unfortunately, that we're facing, even in this sector where, you know, we all talk about cooperation, and I get it, that's what it should be. Yeah. So, you know, Cecilia was talking about how marvelous it would be to cooperate in Africa. I can't agree more. But let me give you an example of how hard it is to cooperate because the principles aren't really there. Let me give you this amazing, very simple number of the cost of 1 ton of carbon on the ETS market after the expansion that Cecilia mentioned on steel and aluminium. So basically, October 10th, when I compare the carbon price in China, is still literally stubbornly 7 euro per ton. Ours is literally 78 euro per ton. So now you may tell me, well, China is, you know, it's not as rich, or it has nothing to do with that. This is companies competing in the same global markets. But by the way, they may be competing in the same Chinese market or in the same European market. So, you know, it just creates nothing less than a literally a wall of lack of competitiveness for European companies, barring the fact that our ETS market is much broader. And by the way, there's no reason for our ETS market to be
much broader because China has the means, i.e., has an amazingly large production of renewables, green hydrogen. So, there's no reason if you think about it. There's simply no reason. I mean, is the Chinese economy more complex? Why would it be? I can't give a single good reason why the price of carbon is 10 times higher in Europe than in China. I just can't find any. And having much less coverage. This is really one of the main reasons of, why Europe remains very uncompetitive with China, let alone deflation, the weak exchange rate. But that, let's forget it for a second because it's unrelated. But this is a very simple thing to compare. So, now we all know what CBAM is all about, but forget about CBAM. It's just a question even of internal competitiveness. Yeah, it's like, how do you deal with an economy that deals with emissions in such a different way? So, for me, what I think we need to realize here is that for Europe, either we change the way we want to approach this problem. And frankly, if we do it the Chinese way, I'm afraid that based on actually this is September's Chinese announcement on NDCs on pledges, we'll all get to 3 degrees, if not more. And this is what people have come up as a conclusion of the quite underwhelming targets for China. So in other words, we. Okay, we could cooperate, but it's like cooperating with, it's like two guys going in opposite directions cooperating. How do you cooperate? I mean, we have to at least agree on very basic principles. So for me, I just feel that by not acknowledging this, we are only using, this is Cecilia, don't take me wrong, it's not you, but this our statement, our July statement. We is grandeur, but without actual actionable plans, as you rightly pointed out. And there can be, because we're talking about different things here, totally different things. So I just want to insist on that very simple note that our carbon price is 10 times that of China, and it covers many more sectors than China. And that is a fact that is not changing. That is stays the same since 2021. And actually getting worse because the speed at which we are including sectors is much faster than that of China, beyond the price. So that for me, there is clearly a different angle to this issue.
Do you want to answer this, Cecilia? Why is the carbon price so different in two economies?
I don't want to sound, first of all, I don't want to sound as if I'm naively thinking that, by saying that there is actually an ongoing cooperation in aligning carbon accounting methodologies and, talking about linking the ETS systems, it doesn't mean the ETS market, it doesn't mean that it's actually happening right now and the way that it should in the optimal. In the optimal form yet. So I do agree with Alisa that there is a huge disparity. There is a huge disparity. The reason why I think that there are like very few sectors that are covered is also a matter of time. I mean, Alisa can contest me on this, but it's generally it has been only power and for 4 years. Only power for 4 years, and even before that, it was only applied for only one province, and then it expanded. And only now we are at like four different sectors. And as I was saying before, the way they account for carbon is different from the way that it is accounted in Europe in different instances. But the way I understand the biggest problem in China at the moment is not a lack of willingness or policy ambition; it's mostly data quality. Data quality is the biggest standalone, let's say, single factor that is between, let's say, policy ambitions and the actual implementation. We're in Tsinghua and just discussing literally with scientists about this, that we're just, showing us, for example, meters to detect, in a better way, that the meters are developed to detect a better way emissions in the cement industry, and then they were discussing about, you know, the an alert system to just basically flag when firms would just deviate. So between the expected emissions that they were, you know, the emissions that would expected to be produced and the one they actually report. And apparently there are still a lot of deviations, you know? So I think it's just a time, I mean, a process is going to take time. I mean, ultimately it also took time for us, huh? Then if that is particularly frustrating, I agree. And I don't think also that they are going to end up with a carbon price that is going to be as high as ours. I don't think that this is like nowhere near in the cards, nor I mean, for them. And I don't think it's realistic. So I don't think we're going to have a full, let's say a full, just a replica of our own ETS, not only in terms of, let's say, processes, but literally in terms of ambition.
Yeah, but on this data quality in the EU, do we have better methods when it comes to measuring this? And is this something that cannot be shared? And
No, this is exactly one of the areas where I said before that there is actual cooperation ongoing. There is actual dialogue, cooperation, tactics. When I say cooperation, it's like literally technological changes. So you have like scientists, engineers, economists getting together to discuss all about this and go super, super like in the nitty-gritty details. So yeah, no, that is ongoing and that is it is present. Then I do share the frustration of Alicia if the pace is low and also if the end result is not intended to be the same. So I don't think that China or the Chinese government even wants to have the same level of ambition as the European ETS.
let's bring the conversation a bit into the broader world, because I hear both of you, basically from Cecilia's side, you're saying that pragmatic technical exchanges can still be helpful. But then for Alicia, the end goal is quite different, right? And then the method is quite different. So you're not sure how we can move forward going on to this nitty-gritty details. But we are running out of time. With the US pulled out from the Paris Agreement, there is no leader when it comes to climate transition. Will the EU or China be able to take up this leadership?
Yes, so let me start by saying that in a way, I said at the very beginning, in a way, the EU and China are called to step up, you know, their leadership. They express the intention to do that, and then when you know, in the moment of truth, then you have a quite disappointing result because neither has you know proposed the NDCs that are nearly enough to be compliant with 1.5. But something that I find very interesting is that, again, once again, the way that the NDCs were approached and then presented presents significant, I say, diversity differences in the level of ambition and approach. So, as said by Alicia before, you know, China has announced in September its NDCs by cutting economy-wide net greenhouse gas emissions by 7 to 10% compared to a peak year that is quite undefined. Can be 2030, can be 2027. 2027, we don't know, by 2035. And this is quite remarkable because it's the first ever absolute emission reduction target. But still, compared to what? You know, what is the baseline? If you don't have a clear baseline, then it's a it kind of leaps, can kind of sound a bit fluffy sometimes. But then at the same time, the President Xi Jinping has pledged also to increase wind and solar capacity to 3,600 gigawatts by 2035, and also raise the non-fossil fuel to over 30% of the total energy consumptions. The fact that this installed energy capacity is not necessarily, you know, then is going necessarily to result in direct, you know, emission reduction because they might also not just not be connected to the grid is something that I think is a little bit like an elephant in the room, also in these rooms in China. But I still think that something that is very much in the mind of everyone is that this is a floor and not a ceiling. It's highly achievable, you know, for literally everyone in China. And there is a big focus on the drivers of the transition. I mean, I agree with what Alicia said. So there is not so much a focus on, there are more like targets on the drivers of the ambition. So, for example, on the installed capacity would be needed to achieve the target rather than the emission reduction itself. This means essentially that then the way we should read then these NDCs is different from how we should read ours. And by the way, correct me if I'm wrong in this, but I have the feeling that the having this kind of less ambitious, very highly achievable targets, on the side of China is also the effect of culture. China cannot lose face. No one can lose face. So in order to ensure that there is a, let's say, confidence on the side of every actor involved, the targets need to be low enough, to be achieved. But please correct me if I'm wrong in this. On the other hand, instead, we have the
I see your China trip is catching up to you, like all these culture differences.
Yes, like there have been so many, so that's something that I came up with. Like, why it might be also just this, because I was discussing this with a lead author that IPCC reported on the mitigation chapter for China in particular, and we're discussing precisely this. And it was like, but we cannot, we cannot commit to something else. What if we fail? What if we fail? They're like, yes, so what? And I find it so interesting. But anyway, in Europe, we have a completely different approach, I would say. So we strive for high ambitious targets to build momentum, to catalyze, like ambition by others. But this can also backfire. I mean, we saw it, in September. Europe came forward with a proposal, so a statement, let's say, of intent, not even an NDC, that is more like a range rather than a set number, and this range is between 66% percent to 72.5% reduction by 2035, and you have to be ideally compliant with the target that it is set for itself for, I mean, it wants to set for itself in 2040. However, the reason why there was just a range and just this intent, it's because the EU is facing internal struggles in setting its own climate ambition. I mean, the European Commission has proposed a 90% emission net emission reduction target by 2040, but member states remain deeply divided over the cost, the competitiveness concerns, over whether to allow international carbon credits or not, and to what extent. I mean, we had just yesterday the Prime Minister of Italy, my country, coming forward saying that while there is a common agreement on the problem, so climate change is a problem that needs to be tackled, then we should argue for more flexibility. So essentially, she's arguing for climate delay, and bringing forward justifications for inaction. This is not particularly constructive. And this is also why, as of today, EU still does not have an NDC. They are supposed to, the environment minister of the EU are supposed to discuss this on November 4th, so very close to the beginning of COP. So it is to be seen exactly what Europe will, go to Belém with. I just said all of this because this is just to say that there are very different, it's very different, the way even the NDC is approached. And I think that to push for more, for higher ambition on either side ahead of COP30 is highly unrealistic. I would be happy with a, say, slightly, I mean, a quite a low target for China, but that gets actually achieved, and actually brings emission reductions, and an NDC for Europe that actually reflects the higher end, so the upper bound, target of the range that is has expressed in September 2025. So what I want to say is, I would be happy with staying the course. And really, to just steal an expression from Ursula von der Leyen, but really do it, Don't necessarily go for higher ambition, but just make sure let's not backtrack.
Thank you for that, Alicia.
Let me give you three reasons why I think face is not enough of a reason to underwhelm as much with these targets. And basically, because the world cannot afford 3 degrees, which is basically the equivalent of, basically, if China were to achieve these targets and not overachieve them, just achieve them, we would basically be on an equivalent of 3 degree plus 3 degrees, other things given. So basically, it's either they overachieve them or we're dead. So, we're playing with fire here, other than face. So, this is why I think it is very important to understand why China is not going further, and it is literally a competitiveness issue. So the minute China gets, which is already very close to, because China is doing enormously well on transportation, it gets closer to industrial emissions. China hits basically, I mean, this touches bone, if you want, because that's where all of the coal is. And there, I think it's important for the audience to understand that China has actually increased coal use in its industrial sector by half. Basically, the increase is half of the global increase in coal use. So in other words, the share of coal used by China out of its own of all of its energy basket is it's basically not decreasing. And I think that is very why? Because the China does fear, and I get it. I mean, China wants to grow. China, I mean, all of these reasons that everybody can understand, but at the end of the day, what this shows is that peaking is fine, but reaching net zero by the deadline, given what we are seeing already with these pledges, is going to be very difficult because China is still not ready. This is the signals to really get into the hard part, which is the decarbonization of the industrial sector. Another example of this is methane. Yeah, I mean, China decided basically not to sign the international agreement on methane, and simply because the Global Methane Pledge, basically launched in 2021, because again, these are the emissions that China cannot, if it wants to remain a major industrial power, actually increasing industrial power, China can't afford it. Yeah, so it is a very, like, how would I say, a la carte decarbonization, if you allow me, And a la carte decarbonization means that once you hit the wall, you cannot go further because you cannot afford, in terms of, what is at stake, growth-wise, export-wise, industrial-wise. So this is what we are seeing from these pledges, that China is hesitant, basically, to go further because it is starting to hurt, because it's in the sectors where China is bound to suffer through decarbonization. So that's why I'm worried about this, because it really shows, okay, Europe maybe didn't think about doing first the easy part, then, and as you rightly point out, Cecilia, maybe they're behind the curve. But also they didn't, how would I say, tactically choose the easiest timeline. So this is the difference. China now is getting to the hard part of the timeline, and the reluctant to move is obvious. So that's why I'm not saying we don't have problems. Europe has a lot of problems. I agree with you, it's disappointing, you name it. But I think China's problem is that it never meant to do the hard part at the same speed. And that's what we are facing now. Yeah.
Thank you for that. I think that leaves a sombering message for the upcoming COP. Of course, here at Bruegel, we will be following it. We will be following it closely, and we will also do a podcast episode. And thank you very much for this interesting conversation. I am Yun Zhan, and I am with Bruegel Senior Fellow Alicia Garcia Herrero and Cecilia Trazzi from EcoThink Tank. For listeners, you can find all our research on China at Bruegel.org and sign up for Zhonghua Mundus, our monthly China podcast and newsletter, with the link in the show notes. Until next time, bye bye.